Radiotopia.
Welcome to the Kitchen Sisters present.
From PRX.
We're the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson
and Nikki Silva.
Hi, I'm excited to tell you that one of our favorite Radiotopia siblings, Ear Hustle, is back with a new season. Ear Hustle is a show about life in prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast. Co-hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods have recently been spending time at four California prisons and have a season's worth of funny, surprising, and unforgettable stories to share. In a recent episode, they were able to visit a groundbreaking prison hospice where they spoke to men who are grappling with the reality of dying inside prison. Also coming up this season are stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells, complicated mom-daughter relationships in prison, and incarcerated people who wonder whether they've become too comfortable behind bars. Stories about life on the inside told by those who live it. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts. The Kitchen Sisters Present is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
My name is Mary Ruth Shuler Dieter. I'm 97 years old. We traveled on horses, riding down in the mountains of Kentucky, a very poor country. I was delivering books to the children. Pay for a librarian. It was one of the works of President Roosevelt.
That's Ruth, one of the last of the Packhorse librarians. Today, episode 2 in the Keepers series, stories of activist archivists, rogue librarians, curators, collectors, and historians. The Kitchen Sisters present the Packhorse Librarians of Eastern Kentucky.
Our problem is to put to work 3.5 million employable persons, men and women, who are now on the relief rolls.
In the Depression, those horrible years after 1929, the Appalachians were hit so hard. Coal mines were being shut down. Lots of people in dire poverty.
Eleanor Roosevelt decided to help create projects that would specifically benefit women and children. My name is Heather Henson, author of that book, Woman. Eleanor Roosevelt felt very strongly about the Packhorse Library Project.
If the women are willing to do this because it's going to help their neighbors, I think we'll win out.
The Packhorse librarians, mostly women, rode circuits around 18 to 20 miles. They followed animal paths, fence lines. I'm Kathy Appelt. I co-wrote Down Cutshin Creek, the Packhorse Librarians of Kentucky. They would stuff their saddlebags or a pillowcase with books and strike out by horseback or mule to provide library service to the remote areas of the Kentucky mountains.
Going into the Appalachian Mountains of Kentucky was going back in time. No running water, no electricity, very few schools. Families live way up in the mountains. A creek bed, that would be the road.
We forded Greasy Creek, take the horses across, got ready wet, way up to your... You don't get afraid. You do your job and that was it.
You had to be hardy, being able to clamber up the side of a mountain on a horse. You had to know the roads and creek beds. My name is Eliza McGraw. I wrote a story about the Packhorse librarians for the Smithsonian.
One county would start a Packhorse library. Another county would hear about it. They would want one. Then that community would ask the WPA to let them hire carriers.
Many of them were women between 25 and 35. There weren't people coming in from outside to take jobs from people who were in the community. They were local women, familiar with the people who wanted to read and what they might want to read.
My grandmother, she was a horseback librarian. She was involved with the WPA because that was the workforce of the time. Because Eastern Kentucky, you either worked or you starved to death. I'm Rick Overby, grandson of Grace Caudle Lucas. She would ride that horse, carriage trails, mud holes, going back up into these hollers. She didn't own the horse. She rented it for 50 cents a week. She would arrange the books in a pack that would ride behind her on the saddle. She would haul around up to 100, not only books, but magazines of the time and newspaper.
Grace was a young mother with two small children. Her husband left. In the Depression, a lot of men did that.
My father left home when I was two and my sister was about a month old. My name's Richard Overby, and I'm the son of Grace Caudle Lucas. My mother, she'd get up every morning about 4:30, feed me and my sister and take us to my grandma's till she got home at night. And then she would feed us and put us to bed and start all over the next day. Dollar a day, she was glad to have it. She bought groceries and things that we'd never had before.
The only thing the federal government provided was the salary for the carriers. My name is Jean Schmitzer, co-author, Down Cut Shin Creek, Packhorse Library of Eastern Kentucky. Lena Knofsier, one of the leaders in the Kentucky Library Association, really goes to bat for this project. She started something called the Penny Fund. It asked for all of the state parent-teacher associations to donate a penny. Children donated pennies. One little school collected enough pennies to make a dollar, and they sent the dollar in.
This being the Depression, it was hard for people to give up anything. I mean, even a penny drive was taxing.
As people from all over the United States learned about this, they would donate cast-off magazines, used books, Swiss Family Robinson, Heidi.
Better Homes and Gardens, National Geographic, Popular Mechanics.
By 1937, they'd gotten 60,000 books.
The librarians would go through these ragged magazines and dilapidated books, and they would cannibalize them, deconstruct them, remix them, and create these new scrapbooks. I am Jason Vance, librarian, Middle Tennessee State University. Library manual for WPA Packhorse Library Projects. The following scrapbooks have been found useful. Recipes, mountain ballads, Kentucky history, odd names, articles on a particular subject, dogs, Spain, Nazis, model airplanes.
Carriers would collect recipes and patterns for quilts from people on the route, put them together into a scrapbook, and share county to county.
In 1940, there were 2,582 of these scrapbooks. They became part of the circulating collection. The Packhorse librarians were creating these cultural artifacts, snapshots of life in Eastern Kentucky during the Great Depression.
They were so happy to get a book, tickled to death. We always sat under the big old chestnut tree. They didn't know how to read. So I read it and read it again so we could understand it.
Kentucky in 1930, illiteracy in those southeastern counties was anywhere from 19 to 31%. Some people were originally a little bit leery of the Packhorse librarians because reading was seen as sort of a leisure activity. When you're trying to get this corn hoed and work done on a small farm, somebody can't be sitting with their feet up reading. This was just frivolous.
There was a lot of illiteracy there. The Packhorse librarians would sit and read to people at the houses, then mount back up and get going. They were really hoofing it to get done before dark.
Grace was out on a winter day, and it started to sleet, ice falling out of the sky. Normally, she might have stopped at one of the households along the way and spent the night, but the last house on her circuit was a family that she knew if she stayed there that they would feed her, and likely that would mean nothing for the kids. So she just pushed on. Before she could get home, she had to cross a creek. The water was high enough, it covered her stirrups. By the time she got home, her feet were encased in ice.
Grace would ride that horse and he would swim through the creeks. She had mountains to climb and valleys to go through.
The program ended in 1943.
We're in the war. We're pulling out of this depression. The library program was no longer funded by the federal government, the salaries for carriers. But 1954, the state of Kentucky starts a bookmobile program.
In Alaska, there are bush plane librarians. In Africa, there's camel librarians.
In Louisiana, there were floating librarians poling flatboats in the bayous.
In Thailand, they were using elephants. In Zimbabwe, they were using donkeys. In Mongolia, they were using horse-drawn wagons.
In our mind, we think of librarians as the quintessential Marion the librarian, somebody who puts the books back on the shelves, dust, and makes sure that everything's tidy. Librarians are a determined bunch. They're far more subversive than that.
We'll be right back. The Kitchen Sisters Present is sponsored by Quip, the electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes while still packing just the right amount of vibrations to help clean your teeth. Quip has a great subscription plan. It delivers new brush heads on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. I like this toothbrush. It's small, sleek, and doesn't clutter up the bathroom with stands and cords. It has a wireless mount that suctions right to your mirror and easily unsticks, so you can use it as a cover for your brush when you travel. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/kitchensisters right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/kitchensisters, getquip.com/kitchensisters. When we began work on the Pack Horse Librarian story, one of the first people we spoke to was Doug Boyd, director of the Louis B. Nunn Center for Oral History at the University of Kentucky Libraries. Doug is a keeper, an oral historian, a folklorist, a techie, a teller. Here's one of our favorite stories from Doug.
Every story matters. The challenge is getting that story to the historical record. Simply putting it in the archive maybe is not enough. I know lots of oral history out there that's just been sitting on a shelf for 20, 25 years. My name is Doug Boyd. I direct the Louis B. Nunn Center for Oral History in the University of Kentucky Libraries. I am also the current president of the Oral History Association. We've got close to 11,000 interviews now in the Nunn Center collections. Some of our key projects are interviewing student veterans who have come back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and a project called City Stories, training people to do the oral history and document their small towns throughout the state. So we're constantly interviewing. But when I came in 2008, I was really frustrated. Oral history has a problem on the archival side with discovery and usability. Nobody was really listening to oral history from the archive. And I have an emphasis on technology. So I created a system called OHMS, time-coded keys in a transcript. So when you search on a word, it takes you to the moment in the audio. And then it hit me. We need to find something more efficient than transcription. So we added the indexing feature to OHMS. You can tag the moment with a title, a description of what's being said, keywords, hyperlinks to photographs, GPS coordinates, for about 1/10 of the cost of a transcript. We went from 500 interviews a year being used to 10 to 12,000 page views a month. The indexing feature really transformed the way we do things. Do you have time for a story? In 2014, we got a request from Italy. The requester was writing his first novel, and he was setting the novel during World War II in this small town on the coast called Tremonsuoli, and he found an interview that we had with Marshall Webb, who had fought in the Battle of Tremonsuoli. It was 1944. So he said, we'll get this ready. There were no restrictions. I said, we might have somebody else who may have fought in that battle. Do you want us to take a look? He says, no. I said, that's weird. Most researchers want everything. I'm just really curious, why are you so interested in Marshall Webb? He sends us a photograph. Marshall Webb carved his name, M.A. Webb, Seville, Kentucky, March 30, 1944, in an alleyway. during the Battle of Tremonswally. Wait a minute. We can triangulate people from a wall in small town Italy with a carving that was created in 1944 to this four-hour interview with Marshall Webb.
Which one is this now?
We was in a small burg. I would say that if this town was populated like in civilian times, it wouldn't have been over 200-300 people, no more than that. And the name of it was Tremonswally.
That kind of magic would have taken a miracle to have made that connection in an analog world. The reason we knew he talked about Tremonswally, the only reason we knew it, was in the description. He broke frame from the interview and started to recite a poem that he had written about the Battle of Tremonswally.
As we reached our main objective, but just at the break of day, death and hell struck our company. All around me, my buddies lay. As I knelt down by my buddy, he knew it was his time. Thank God we won our victory. We hold the Gustavline. You can talk of all your battles, and history it will tell, but the one fought at Tremonswally was sure a bloody hell.
Most of your World War II veterans don't do that in mid-interview. We connected with the family. The widow was still alive. The children were still alive. Went down and interviewed them. He had written over 80 poems during the war.
He wrote them while he was in the war, yes. But whatever was happening to him, that's what he wrote. Even all the years we were married, she never quit writing. He always wrote poetry.
She's like, do you want to put him in the archive? I was like, yes, we do. We digitized all of his poems. Some of them are just about the food. They're about losing friends, longing for home. Tremonswally was probably 10% of the interview. Colonel Arthur L. Kelly, the interviewer introduces him, was part of the first group that went into Dachau concentration camp after liberation. The majority of the interview was about that experience.
What do you see when you get up closer?
We thought that there was a bunch of people here, maybe wounded or alive people, that we were going to liberate them. But it was not a way.
This picture you have right here of these of these bodies that are skin and bones, how'd you get those pictures?
There was a guy in our outfit developing it.
And later in the interview, Marshall can't remember the name of the actual concentration camp. Right. He just can't connect to the name. Colonel Kelly is doing everything he can, like a good interviewer would.
Well, let me ask you this. How did you get to it? Did you walk upon it?
We walked and rode.
And you were moving up the road lickety-split?
Can you tell me where you stayed the night before? Did you see any signs when you marched in? Describe the camp to me.
I can't tell you. I can't.
And he can't get Marshall to connect, and he never does throughout the course of the interview. When we connected to the family, Marshall's son brought all the photographs. He said, you got us all whipped up with nostalgia. We got Dad's journals out, and you got to see this. Marshall kept a journal that was kind of like your smartphone. You know, it wasn't like, I feel sad today type of diary. It was like, ran into Bill, got to call him back, phone number. He pulls out this journal, and he starts flipping through the pages. One of Marshall's daughters passed away very young of cancer, 1992. She was in her 30s. He turns to the page that coincided with that, and it says, Eva passed away today. Funeral arrangements. You turn the page, and it says, the name of the prison camp was Dachau. So it was like 6 years after this interview, which is just, like, mind-blowing. The name of the prison camp was Dachau. You can experience this whole thing just because this guy did a Google search on M.A. Webb. Mrs. Webb, who I just love dearly, the whole family I've just come really to love. I asked her,
did he ever mention that he carved his name in a wall?
He never mentioned, but he carved his name on everything. If you could go through the Pikes Ridge woods out there where he grew up, his initials are on everything. My son climbed a tree once when they were deer hunting and found his dad's initials and a date way up on the tree. So, yeah, he's doing what he always did.
We did a story on YouTube. It got picked up in the Tremonswally newspaper, and people started going over, doing rubbings of his signature. Send me pictures. The town put up a plaque on the wall. They have the picture of him. They have a scan of the Battle of Tremensuale poem. And at the bottom, they've got a link. And if you have a really good international data plan, you can sit there in this alleyway and listen to the man's voice, Marshall Webb, at the moment that he talks about coming to Tremensuale.
Tremensuale. That's where we were at, dug in for roughly 3 months. Mm-hmm. At that time, I was a scout. The 5th Army and the 8th Army, the English, that stretched all the way across Italy.
Okay.
Now, this was wrote the 10th of May. Somewhere in Italy, on the 11th of May, we waited for our orders one cool, cloudy day.
We have a link to Marshall Webb's YouTube story at kitchensisters.org. As part of our Keeper series, we have this Keeper of the Day project. We asked writer Eliza McGraw about the keepers in her life.
When I first heard about that idea, I thought of my Uncle Bill, who compulsively does dairy histories here in Montgomery County, Maryland. Like, he's not a librarian. He's not an archivist. He's not trained, but they're from a dairy family. And there's this big dairy barn sitting in the middle of a soccerplex out in Boyds, Maryland. And my mother-in-law and Uncle Bill saved this and turned it into a dairy museum, which they call the Museum.
Bill DeVall.
Hi, Bill. This is Nikki Silva of the Kitchen Sisters.
All right. Let me get where I can talk to you. I'm up at the barn here today.
How's it going up at the barn?
Pretty good. It hasn't started raining yet.
So tell me, Bill, how did you get into this whole thing?
Well, around 1999, Hendrix, the CEO of Discovery Channel, offered Montgomery County $1 million to take a piece of ground and build a bunch of soccer fields on it. And the citizens of Germantown got together. Their first priority was saving this farm setting. So the battle ensued. They got me involved and they got my sister involved because this had been my grandfather's farm from 1913 to 1962. My sister, Barbara DeVall McGraw, was the key spokesman for saving the barn and proposing that we turn it into a museum, the King Barn Dairy Museum. M-O-O-M-U-S-E-U-M. We feel like we're one of a kind. We're cataloging dairy artifacts that date back into the 1800s, the churns and the cream separators. We have a 1900 one-horse milk wagon used in Westminster. We are mapping all of the farmers that ship milk in Montgomery County. We've recorded 437 so far. We have a full-size model of Pachymer astronaut, the famous Maryland Bull. His mother had phenomenal milk production and butterfat records. His offspring are in 44,414 cows currently. Those cows are in 26,000 herds in the United States. 10 guys syndicated in 1964, and people thought they were nuts because they each put up $1,000 apiece for a 6-month-old bull calf. They each made $1,358,000. Pretty famous bull.
Wow. When you were coming up and throughout your life, did you ever imagine that you would become the keeper of this story in Maryland?
Not at all.
What made you feel it was important to do this?
Well, it kind of grows on you, and it is fun. And also, you meet some really nice people. You know, I do these dairy histories. I get with these families, and boy, they go back and pull out some really interesting pictures. You see how things changed on the farm with reduced labor during World War II. We used a lot of German war prisoners. Prisoners were all kept over at Emery Grove in a camp. 200 of them were there. You know, my father and his papers still had receipts where he went and got them in the morning, yet pay the Farm Bureau 42.5 cents an hour for their work, and then that money was transferred to the War Department.
That's a story, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you think of yourself as a keeper?
Well, I think of the Dairy Museum as a keeper, but I personally feel like I'm a keeper. This was a major dairy county up until the 70s and 80s when all the development started. And we're scrambling right now, just like the historians are scrambling to do oral histories with World War II veterans that are disappearing. Our old farmers are disappearing by the day. So we're recording that history.
Well, Bill, thank you for being a keeper.
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much.
We'd love to hear from you. Bye-bye. Call the Keepers Hotline with your tips and suggestions of keepers who need to be chronicled. 415-496-9049. That's 415-496-9049. Or visit us at kitchensisters.org and tell us what you think. The Packhorse Librarians of Eastern Kentucky was produced by the Kitchen Sisters with Nathan Dalton and Brandy Howell, mixed by Jim McKee. Thanks to our production intern, Celine Ross, for her work on the Doug Boyd story. Special thanks to Eleanor Roosevelt, Ruth Schuler Dieter, one of the last of the Packhorse Librarians.
That is Jim. He was a white horse, good-looking horse, and a very gentle, kind horse.
And thanks to producer Laura Ziegler, who helped us with Ruth's interview. Thanks to Grace Caudill-Lucas, Rick Overby Sr., Rick Overby Jr.
My grandmother, Grace Caudill-Lucas, one of the Packhorse librarians, she liked to raise kids. She was a foster mother to over 40 children.
We thank Heather Henson, Jason Vance, Jean Schmitzer, and Kathy Appelt.
A library is the heartbeat of democracy. If information becomes short-circuited or unavailable, we are not really operating in a democratic society.
We thank Mark Edwards and Rick Howard at KAMU, Cameron Atkins, WPLN, John Lumgwe, WUKY, Brent Clark, WCTE, Mac Dula, WMFE, Bill Dean and Cincinnati Public Radio, Donald C. Boyd, Doug Boyd, Eliza McGraw, Barbara Duval McGraw, and Bill McGraw.
Our website is King Barn Dairy Moo Zim.
Love that.
Yep.
We thank Debbie Barber, Pine Mountain Settlement School, Apple Shop, Berea College, FDR Library, Kentucky Historical Society, Nathan Salzberg, and the Alan Lomax Archive. We want to give a big shout-out to our mighty crew of Kitchen Sisters interns, Vika Aronson, Juliet Gelfman-Randazzo, Juliet Luini, Grant McCammer, Michael Wisnowski, Katie McCutcheon, Taylor Simmons, Bailey McMillan, Paulina Hartano, and Mary Franklin Harbin. Special thanks to Jacob Conrad at NPR, and Bella Fleck and Abigail Washburn.
Never thought I'd go back. Hills and hollers pulling down on me. Kentucky's such a long way. There's an echo in the valley.
Funding for the Keepers is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and listener contributions to the Kitchen Sisters Productions. Many thanks.
The Kitchen Sisters Present is part of Radiotopia from PRX, a curated network of extraordinary cutting-edge podcasts created by independent producers.
We'd like to introduce you to our sonic sister, Kathy Bird, and her podcast, Fresh Art International. Kathy delves into contemporary culture and creative communities around the world. She shares inspiring stories about today's art, design, and film. Fresh Art International has grown an archive of more than 200 episodes since 2011. Listen to new Fresh Art International stories every week, anywhere you go for your podcasts. I think you're really going to like this show.
Radiotopia.